welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, economics, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on eminent domain and the Kello case when we come back. You know, in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." That clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Well, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin, but public business is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit, credit cards, debt, and usury. Well, back in 1965, Congress said that there was no difference in the value of gold and silver coin or clad coin and currency. You know that's very true when you're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries, but out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in purchasing power and a 7-to-1 difference in taxes that are due on that paper money over gold. Now, God and our founding fathers did not give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. They knew, and they knew full well in 1933, that in order to subjugate a free people, they would first have to take away their gold and silver coin, to take away the people's right to property, and to destroy their property rights. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and our property rights. And that's because property is the legal foundation of all of our liberties. Now, let me teach you how to do just that. That's in my business school, which is now on compact disc for adult homeschoolers. Now, for more information about my private business school, why don't you start first with the General Law CD package. Just call and order that CD package. It's free of charge. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational. Best of all, it's free of charge. You can call right now, the number 417-273-4967. Now, my business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine, then send an email request for that free General Law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? Remember, georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the Kello case. Remember Kello, the lady in New London, Connecticut, who owns a house. And the city of New London wants to take her house. Mainly what they want is her land. She does not own the land. She does not own the house. She has an equitable interest in it. She pays a property tax on it. She has a split estate. She has some property rights. And I told you last time that the most important property right that she has is the location and the view. Those are called incorporeal property rights. Now, property is the foundation of law. You either have property or you don't. If you have property, you can exclude God Almighty Himself from that property. We saw that in the definition last program. Now, Miss Kello has her eye on the wrong rabbit trail. Government has always had the power. I showed you that from the scripture. Government has always had the power of eminent domain. I mean, that's a given. The argument that is being made today is government should not have the power to take your home for public purpose. They should be able to take your home to build, oh, such things as schools and docks and forts and arsenals and shipyards, but they shouldn't be able to take it for urban renewal or for a big box store or for jobs or for taxes or for any other reason. Now, that issue was just answered in what's known as the Kello case by the Supreme Court, a split decision 5-4. I said I was surprised. I was surprised that it wasn't 9-0. That's the way I would have voted. The court, I contend, ruled correctly. Everybody that has been writing about the Kello case says, oh, my God, the Supreme Court made a terrible, grievous, horrible mistake here. No, it wasn't the Supreme Court that made that terrible, grievous, horrible mistake. It was the Congress of the United States and the President of the United States in 1933 with the enactment of an obscure public law called House Joint Resolution 192, which was later codified into a public law and then made into a statute. We see it in Title 31 of the U.S. Code today. And what that House Joint Resolution 192 did was it destroyed our property rights in America. And it ushered in the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for the abolition of all right to property and land. Now, all wealth comes out of the ground. All wealth comes out of the ground. Don't forget that. All wealth comes out of the ground. And he who owns the ground owns all the wealth. And there's a statute in the scripture I showed you that God owns all of planet Earth, every square foot of it, and has never relinquished title to one square foot on this planet. He calls the earth his footstool. And there's a statute that says the land shall not be sold forever. And he that's established in the land shall not be removed forever. But being established in the land is something different than what we Americans vision it today by paying property tax on a piece of real estate, having an equitable interest in a mortgage, paying interest, no less. So I pointed out to you yesterday, I'll repeat it again, that in Miranda versus Arizona, we read a very poignant statement. It's on page 491, Miranda. Miranda, by the way, is cited at 384 U.S. 436. On page 491, listen to what the court told us. They said, where rights secured by the Constitution are involved, there can be no rulemaking or legislation which would abrogate them. If Mrs. Kello actually had a property right in that property over there, and if she was interested in securing that property right or being compensated justly for it, her argument would have been over compensation, not over whether or not this land usage or this land taking was for a public purpose. For us little guys down here at the bottom of the totem pole, it doesn't make any difference whether it's for a public purpose or not. If the government wants to take it, they're going to take it. And I showed you two examples from Anglo-Saxon administration that started with King David, who took a piece of ground and paid for it, and then Ahab and Jezebel, who took a piece of ground and didn't pay for it, and what the penalties were. Now let me show you from the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. This is called the Sixth Protocol. Now this is the way land is going to be dealt with. This is the way land is being dealt with today in the United States of America, and I suspect also in Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. In fact, I'd be surprised if you people in Australia and New Zealand are dealing with land any differently than we do here in the United States. Listen to this protocol. It says, we shall soon begin to establish huge monopolies, colossal reservoirs of wealth, upon which even the big Gentile properties will be dependent to such an extent that they will all fall together with the government credit on the day following the political catastrophe. We're all sitting on the edges of our seats right now, waiting for the political catastrophe, waiting for the collapse of the world's economies. And George Bush and the American Congress are just working every day. They're working their hearts out to collapse the world's economies. They are spending. Listen, Alan Greenspan is creating billions of dollars of new credit per week in an attempt to collapse the world economy. Ladies and gentlemen, you are sitting on the cusp of the greatest and most momentous event since Noah's flood. Well, that's what Jesus said in Matthew 24. I told you that the other day. Now, he says, the economists here present must carefully weigh the significance of this combination, and we must develop by every means the importance of our super government, we call that the United Nations today, representing it as the protector and the benefactor of all who voluntarily submit to us. This protocol, by the way, was written in 1884. Now, the aristocracy of the Gentiles as a political force has passed away. We need not take them into consideration. But as owners of the land, get that word land there? But as owners of the land, this Mrs. Kello is dangerous to us. They say they are harmful to us in that they are independent in their sources of livelihood. Therefore, at all costs, we must deprive them of their land. All right, so number one, we have to be deprived of our land because if we have land, we become independent. We are not controllable. And remember, the New World Order is all about control. And that's what this terrorism program is all about. I mean, if you take a look at terrorism, boys and girls, it's the equivalent of a flea crawling up an elephant's ass with rape on his mind. That's what terrorism today represents. In World War I, there were battles in which 40,000 Englishmen were killed in a single day. If you took all of the deaths from terrorism from 1980 to today, 25 years, it wouldn't total 10,000 people worldwide, including the IRA and every terrorist group that's been operating over the last 25 years, haven't killed 10,000 people. That's why I said it's a flea on an elephant's ass with rape on his mind. And yet, the Bush administration has succeeded in convincing Americans that they should give up their fundamental constitutional Bill of Rights for protection by the government from these terrorists. Well, okay, boys and girls, if that's what you want to do, you certainly have a right to make that choice. But if you'll remember, I've told you from time to time in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 that God said he would send a faintness into our hearts and that we would flee when none pursues. And we Americans are fleeing before these terrorists, and they're not even pursuing us. We're in full-fledged flight, terrorized by the terrorists. I think we're terrorized more by the terrorists in Washington than the terrorists in Afghanistan. Now, they go on to tell us that the best means to attain this is to increase the taxes and the mortgage indebtedness. These measures will keep land ownership in a state of unconditional subordination. Unable to satisfy their needs by small inheritances, the aristocrats among the Gentiles will burn themselves out rapidly. Now, this is accomplished by the implementation of the first plank to the Communist Manifesto. We have abolished the Ten Commandments and Thou Shalt Not Steal and replaced it with the Ten Planks to the Communist Manifesto, and the first plank calls for the abolition of all right to property and land. And Mrs. Kello's right to property and land has been abolished. It has been replaced by zoning and planning. But remember, I mentioned that House Joint Resolution 192 is the linchpin. Now, we'll take a look at HDR 192 and the ramifications of gold and silver coin at Article 1, Section 10, and your ability to pay your debts at law or discharge your obligations in equity. Payment versus discharge. Stand by. It's coming up. Now, at the same time, they go on to tell us, it is necessary to encourage trade and industry vigorously, and especially speculation. Speculation. Now, this is put your money into the stock market, put your money into bonds, put your money into real estate bubbles. We're going to encourage speculation, the function of which is to act as a counterpoise to industry. Now, remember, industry has been exported from America to China. We, in 1960, 53% of the GDP in America was industry. Today, it's 9%. So we have accomplished this. And without speculation, industry will cause private capital to increase and tend to improve the condition of agriculture by freeing the land from indebtedness for loans by the land banks. Now, today, in this speculative real estate bubble, we have these arms. These arms, they're called interest-only loans, adjustable-rate mortgages.
And the speculation that's going on in the housing industry with this fiat currency and a constant striving for more and more profit. But we don't want property. We want profit. So we Americans have exchanged property and property rights for profit, and we've exchanged increase, tithing and increase, for income and income tax. Now, what do you suppose that's all about? You know, it's necessary for industry to deplete the land both of laborers and capital, and through speculation transfer all of the money of the world into our hands, thereby throwing the Gentiles into the ranks of the proletariat. The Gentiles will then bow before us to obtain the right to existence. Sixth Protocol, published in 1920 by Henry Ford, came out of Europe in 1884. All right, now with that in mind, let me tell you a little story. It's called the Czech Story. Now, I said that I would tell you here that House Joint Resolution 192. Listen to this. 20 years after enactment of the Federal Reserve Act, on June 5, 1933, Congress enacted House Joint Resolution 192 to suspend the gold standard and to abrogate the gold clause. This resolution declared that, quote, here's Congress speaking now, whereas the holding or dealing in gold affect the public interest and are therefore subject to the proper regulation and restriction, and whereas the existing emergency, this is the Great Depression, has disclosed that provisions of obligations which purport to give the obligee a right to require payment in gold as a particular kind of coin or currency are inconsistent with the declared policy of Congress in the payment of debts. Period. This resolution declared that any obligation requiring payment in gold or a particular kind of coin or currency or in an amount in money of the United States measured thereby is declared to be against public policy. Notice Congress didn't say it was unconstitutional, it said it's against public policy. And that every obligation heretofore or hereafter incurred shall be discharged, not paid, but discharged upon payment, dollar for dollar, in any coin or currency which at the time of payment is legal tender for all debts, public and private. Now, interestingly enough, the words do not talk about payment of debt, but clearly states that every obligation shall be discharged. Why did Congress take our gold away from us in 1933? And then later, in 1965, President Lyndon Johnson took our silver coin away. Why was that necessary? Why was that done? Let me share with you a little piece of information. I've shared this with you more than once, but I want to share it with you once more. As it deals with education. One of the major world arenas in which Hegelian philosophy and materialistic and anti-psychology of want has been applied is that of education. In 1819 in Prussia, the first compulsory schooling for children was instituted. According to educator John Taylor Gatto, society in Prussia was divided into children who will become policymakers, children who will become assistants to the policymakers, and children who will be the vast, massed, used workers. So Prussia set up a three-tier school system in which one-half of 1% of the population is taught to think. They go to school called academia. 5.5% of the population go to real schooling, where they partially learn to think, but not completely. And that was because Prussia believed that their defeat at the hands of Napoleon was caused by people thinking for themselves at times of stress on the battlefield. They were going to see to it that scientifically this couldn't happen again. The lowest 94%, now that's some pyramid, the lowest 94% went to Volksschulen, where they were to learn harmony, obedience, freedom from stressful thinking, and how to follow orders. And they worked out a system that would, in fact, guarantee just such a result. Now, our educational system is designed to dumb down the American people, and they have succeeded in doing that. That's why I thought this week, let's take a look at, let's see if we can think outside of the box. What happened in the Kellogg case? everybody is convinced that Mrs. Kellogg got the raw deal and that the Supreme Court is the culprit. The Supreme Court made the mistake. The Supreme Court did this. Now, I'm going to take the Supreme Court side in this. I'm disappointed that it didn't come down 9-0, but the opinion came down correctly. Came down correctly based upon the law. You can't have property and property rights while you're practicing the first plank to the Communist Manifesto. You can't have property and property rights without gold and silver coin, boys and girls. You can't have property and property rights with zoning and planning and building permits. In short, you cannot be a virgin at the same time you're a practicing whore. We call those oxymorons. Now, the court was split. The four minority voters are sitting there saying, my God, this will open the door to the destruction of property rights. Well, the destruction of property rights has already occurred. That occurred when you lost your gold and silver. That occurred when Mrs. Kellogg was unable to buy that house and own it. So she does have some property rights, but she doesn't have exclusive property rights. She has a split estate. The city of New London actually owns the rock, the mineral, the dirt. The Federal Reserve Bank actually owns the boards, the nails, and the glass. And Mrs. Kellogg owns the right to use it, and the view, and the location. So there are three parties that own Mrs. Kellogg's land. Two of the parties work in concert against Mrs. Kellogg. That's the Federal Reserve that makes your fiat paper currency and destroyed your right to gold and silver and your capacity to pay your debts at law. And the City of New London, which is a corporation under Hale versus Hinkle, created by the legislature, which owns the rock, the mineral, and the earth, and collects a rent off of that property every year. And Mrs. Kellogg goes down to the city hall, and she pays that rent. So there's a three-party limited general partnership between Mrs. Kellogg, the City of New London, and the Federal Reserve System. Those are the three partners. And those three partners are in business. They're in business to make profit and gain. And the City of New London and the Federal Reserve have teamed up together as a matter of law through the legislature of Connecticut and decided that there's more profit to be made in this three-party limited general partnership by taking this land and using it for another purpose, such as a hotel and shopping and commercial. And of course Mrs. Kellogg is entitled to some kind of payment for her one-third interest in this three-party limited general partnership. Nobody's denying that. But Mrs. Kellogg is arguing the wrong issue. She went into court to argue, is this taking for public purpose? When she should have been arguing, is this taking my property without just compensation? Who's going to pay her for the view and the location? She has an equitable interest in this three-party limited general partnership. Just picture three of us, me, you, and your wife. And we go out and we buy an apartment house. And we all agree that George Gordon should be the property manager of the property. And then one day, you and your wife come to me, and I'm the property manager, and you say, you'd like to have an accounting. And I say, that's preposterous. I don't have to make any accounting to you. That's the Federal Reserve. It's an Eleemosynary trust. There's never been an accounting. There's never been an audit of the Federal Reserve. You can't audit an Eleemosynary trust, boys and girls. So the Federal Reserve is set up as an Eleemosynary trust. They're not auditable. Furthermore, I've got a one-third interest in this building. So you people can't sell it or do what you want with it without my permission. And then when I come along and I team up with one of the other members, I can force a sale because two of us can force a sale. And that's the power of eminent domain. It's the power that the state has that you don't have. You see, as the property manager, I've got powers as a matter of law that you people don't have. Now, tuck that one away in your heart. All right, now there's one more facet to this story here. In a court case, the legal distinction between the words payment and discharged was explained. Now, you know, you go down to the store, you go down to Walmart, and you want to buy a pair of tennis shoes, and you flip out your credit card, or you flip out some Federal Reserve notes, and you pay for those tennis shoes, and you walk out of the store, and you go out in the parking lot, and you put on those tennis shoes, and you run around the parking lot, and you say to yourself, you know, if I said, where'd you get those shoes? And you say, I got them from Walmart. And I said, what'd you pay for them? He says, well, I bought them from Walmart for $49.95. I say, well, how'd you pay for them? Well, I paid for them with Federal Reserve notes. I paid for it with my credit card. I paid for it with a check. We use the word pay. Well, lay people use the word pay. As a matter of law, you didn't pay for those shoes. As a matter of law, you discharged the obligation in equity, and you don't own those shoes. Somebody owns them, all right, but it's not you. Now, you're the holder in due course. You're the equitable interest holder. You're in possession of the shoes. And the normal people, you know, they say, well, if I'm in possession, I must own it. Now, come on, boys and girls. You go down and rent a car from Ryder. You go down and rent you rent something from the A1 rental down there. You don't sit there and say to people, I own this, because you rented it now, do you? You know, you live in a house, but you're paying property tax on it, and if you don't pay the property tax, they'll take that house and sell it on the courthouse steps to somebody that will. Or you're making a mortgage payment on it, and if you don't pay the mortgage, the bank will foreclose and give the house to somebody else. So there are forces at work there that have the power to take that house away from you, have the power to repossess that car. So the reality of it is Mrs. Keller doesn't own that house. She has an equitable interest in it. Now, here's the difference between a payment or a discharge. There's a distinction between a debt discharged and a debt paid. When a debt is discharged, the debt still exists, even though that debt has been divested of its character as a legal obligation during the operation of the discharge. Something of the original vitality of that debt continues to exist, and that debt may be transferred even though the transferee takes it subject to its disability incident to the discharge. The fact that that debt carries something which may be a consideration for a new promise to pay, so as to make an otherwise worthless promise a legal obligation, makes it the subject of transfer by assignment. Now, that's a statement or a quotation from Stanek versus White, cited at 172 Minnesota 390. Let me read that to you in plain English so that maybe you can better understand it. There's a clear distinction between a debt that's discharged and a debt that's been paid. When a debt is discharged, it is not extinguished. It continues to exist. When a debt is discharged, it changes its character. When a debt is paid, the debt is extinguished, it's terminated, it's absolved, it's wiped out. But when a debt is discharged, it continues to exist. A discharge then transfers the debt to the next person in line, like the old maid in a card game. And the person who accepts the discharge agrees that there is a disability that he accepts as a condition of the discharge. The disability that he accepts is the loss of his property and the loss of his property rights in both the money and the product or service. And he accepts this disability voluntarily in exchange for the profit that he makes on the transaction. Ah. Now, that's quite a little story. Now, why did the Congress and the President of the United States, Franklin Roosevelt, want to take our gold coin away from us in 1933? They took our gold coin away because gold coin is the means by which we pay, by which we absolve, by which we extinguish our debts. And by extinguishing the debt, we become the owners in fee of property. And property is something that you own to the exclusion of everybody else in the world, and everybody else in the universe, which includes God Almighty himself. So it was vitally important to implement the first plank to the Communist Manifesto by taking away our gold coins so that we could not pay our debts. But we could still buy, sell, and trade, and we could still own equitable interest in property, but it wouldn't be an absolute ownership of property. It would be conditional. Conditional. And that's why in the protocol you read here, they say, the economists here present must carefully weigh the significance of this combination. We must develop by every means the importance of our super government, representing it as the protector and benefactor of all who voluntarily submit to us. And they say this, as owners of the land, they are harmful to us in that they are independent in their sources of livelihood. Therefore, at all costs, we must deprive them of their land. Mrs. Kello must be deprived of her land. Well, Mrs. Kello is in possession of her land. She's in possession of her house. She believes that she's the owner of the house. She's in possession of it. Just like renting a car from Hertz. You believe that because you're in possession of it, you own it. Do you? Now, you've got a rental contract and you know better. But you see, you've got a rental contract on that house, Mrs. Kello, and you believe that you own it, when in reality you have an equitable interest in it. That's the ruse. That's the trick. Now, let's take our break here for the halfway point. Let me give you a couple of reminders, and then we'll come back and we'll take a look at some more of this thing called payment versus discharge right after this. Remember, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. Remember, The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. That also can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call direct 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. And finally, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org, or call the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. 4967, or go to the website georgegordon.org. All right, we're talking about property and property rights. Let me tell you a little story. When I was a boy, my dad used to send me down to the corner grocery store in the days before we had supermarkets like Safeway and Kroger. About every four blocks, you'd be walking down 8th Street, and there'd be a little corner grocery store. Harry Connick was our corner grocery. He was just a half a block from our house. So it was common, remember, in the days before refrigeration, that if we wanted a quart of milk and a loaf of bread, we would go down to the local grocery store and pick up a quart of milk and a loaf of bread, and we did that about every day. Now, my daddy could not trust a little kid 5 years old with money. I mean, after all, some big bad kid might come along and take that money away from him. Or, being irresponsible at age five, maybe I would lose the money or something like that. So my daddy would write a little note, and in the note, it would say something like, "Dear Harry, please give little Georgie a quart of milk and a loaf of bread. Signed, Daddy Gordon." And then maybe a little P.S. down at the bottom, "I'll pay you when I see you." So I would take that note, and I'd go down to Harry, and I would reach up onto the counter, and I'd put that note on the counter, and old Harry would look down at me, and he'd say, "Now, you wait right here, little Georgie," and he'd go get the bread and the milk. He'd put it in a bag, and then he would walk me over to the door, and he'd tuck that bag up under my arm, and he'd ask me if I've got a real good grip on it. And then he would point up the street toward my house, and he said, "Now you go right straight home, little Georgie, with this bread and milk." So I would walk out of Harry's store and walk up the street, and Harry would take the note, and he would put the note in his cash register. And a legal question arises. Legal question arises. Who owns the bread and milk when little Georgie is walking up the street? Well, there's three potentials here. Harry still owns the bread and milk because he hasn't been paid for it yet. Daddy hasn't come down to pay. So Harry Connick is still the owner of the bread and milk. But we have heard that possession is 9 points of the law. And little Georgie is in physical possession of the bread and milk walking up the street. And then we might have heard that, well, Daddy owns the bread and milk because the note is the execution of a promise to pay. You know, kind of like the execution of a promissory note on your house. You own the house because you're in possession of it. Or if somebody else is in possession of it, you're renting it, you've got the legal title to it, evidenced by the promissory note. But you see, boys and girls, as a matter of law, only one of those three entities can actually own that bread and milk. So you mull that one over a little bit. Now, does Harry own the bread and milk because he hasn't been paid? Does Georgie own the bread and milk because he's in possession? Or does Daddy own the bread and milk as evidenced by the promissory note? Now, there isn't a judge in America that'll make a mistake on this point. It's a legal point. Every judge in America knows the answer to the riddle. And the answer is, Daddy Gordon owns the bread and milk. Daddy Gordon owns the bread and milk. And he owns the bread and milk because, even though he's not in possession of the bread and milk, and he hasn't paid for the bread and milk, he's the legal owner of the bread and milk because Harry alienated himself from his property. And remember that one of the ways that you extinguish your right to property is by alienation. Take a look at Beauvais on property again. And remember that the bread and milk over here is not the property per se, but it is the subject of property. Daddy Gordon isn't even in possession of the property itself, the physical property. But because he executed a promissory note, Harry Connick can sue Daddy Gordon for the value of the bread and milk. But Harry Connick is never entitled to the bread and milk. Little Georgie Gordon is an agent who is in actual physical possession of the bread and milk, but he doesn't have any legal claim to the bread and milk any more than UPS has a legal claim to a package that they're delivering to you while it's in transit. So little Georgie is incompetent. He can't own the bread and milk. Daddy owns the bread and milk because he's got title to it. Harry alienated himself from the bread and milk, and he doesn't own it. Now, let me take this one step further. Remember, you went into Walmart and you bought a watch. Just look at the watch on your wrist and ask yourself this question. Who owns that watch? And you sit there and you look at that watch and you say to yourself, well, I own that watch. I'm in possession of it and I paid for it. And I say to you, well, how did you pay for it? And you say, well, I paid for it with Federal Reserve notes. Okay? So you went into Walmart with Daddy's note. Remember that Federal Reserve note? And it says, right at the top of that piece of paper, it says Federal Reserve note. Now go to the dictionary and look up the word note and find out what it is. See, you people look at this Federal Reserve note and you say, well, that's money. No, it's not. It's not money at all. It's a note. It's an obligation. Furthermore, it's not even yours. It says very plainly on there, Federal Reserve note. It doesn't say George Gordon's note. Remember the word property? The note, the debt, is not the property of the debtor. Look it up. I read it to you yesterday. So when you go out here with somebody else's debt note, the Federal Reserve's debt note, and you use that in exchange for goods and services, you don't own the goods and services that you just purchased with the note. The Federal Reserve owns the goods and services. And that's the implementation of the first plank to the Communist Manifesto. It's the abolition of your right to property. And you don't own your house, you don't own your car, you don't own the watch that you're wearing on your wrist, you don't own your underwear, your socks, or your t-shirts. The Federal Reserve owns them all. And you have an equitable interest in the Federal Reserve's property. And they're not even in possession of it. So when you go into Walmart, Walmart alienates themselves from the watch and gives it to you. You're the holder in due course. But the guy that paid for that with the note, as a matter of law, owns it. That's why I mentioned to you, I said the crime was committed way back in 1933 with House Joint Resolution 192. The Supreme Court is ruling correctly. Mrs. Kello doesn't own the house. She has an equitable interest. She has some property rights. But she's not asserting her property rights over the things that she should be justly compensated for. She sees her property in the nails and boards and glass of her house, in the rocks, the mineral, and the dirt that's under it. And she looks at that and she says, that's my property. No, it isn't, Mrs. Kello. That property belongs to the Federal Reserve in New London, Connecticut. What you own is the view and the location, the equitable interest in the property where it's located, which, by the way, just happens to be the most valuable of the property rights, which, remember, are incorporeal property rights, not tangible property rights, not the rocks, the mineral, and the dirt. But the view and the location is what you own. And instead of suing for the view and the location, you sued and asked the court to make a decision. You said, now, court, I want you to decide whether or not this is for public purposes. And the court came back and said, yep, it's for public purpose. Now you got one more shot before you're aced out of your property rights. You got one more shot. What's it worth? Now, there's two questions here. Number one is this for a public purpose? And number two, what's just compensation? Now, there's three partners in this transaction: the City of New London, the Federal Reserve, and Miss Kello. Three of you. Okay, now the Federal Reserve and New London said, we want that property. We want to build a commercial venture here. Remember, when this commercial venture is built, it's going to be built with bank credit. And they're going to take this property from these 16 people worth $200,000 each. Let's just take $200,000 times 16, and that's going to be about $3,200,000. So in round numbers, we're going to take $3 million worth of real estate, worth of rocks, mineral, and dirt, worth of glass and boards, and we're going to bulldoze all of that down, haul it off to the landfill, and we're going to end up with just the rock, the mineral, and the earth, which Mrs. Kello is going to be divorced from by eminent domain. And now we're going to build a hotel. And we're going to build a hotel on this particular piece of real estate because it overlooks the bay. That's the view. That's the thing that's worth so much money. If they built this hotel anywhere else except over the bay, it wouldn't be worth as much. It's Mrs. Kello that owns that particular piece of real estate, which overlooks that bay. The location and the view are the incorporeal property rights that Mrs. Kello has that she's not even arguing about. They've got her mind on, is this a public use for this property? And I'm sitting here saying, what in the hell difference does it make to us what they're going to use the property for? I mentioned that to you last time. I said, what if the Navy took it and built a submarine base there? What if the city took it or the railroad took it and built a spur, a railroad siding down along there? A dock, a fort, an arsenal, or a shipyard, a school, a hospital, a freeway. Mrs. Kello is just as deprived of the property, the view, and the location, irrespective, irregardless. not quite the right word, I guess, but, you know, irrespective of who it is that took the property. Come on, boys and girls. This may happen to you one of these days. And when it does, let's have a firm understanding of how the law is going to deal with this circumstance, this event. Now, it's true that this taking of individuals' property for urban redevelopment or for some commercial venture is fraught with fraud and fraught with all kinds of mischief. But after all, there's nothing illegal about it. We made that change. Congress came along and made that change with House Joint Resolution 192, remember? All right. Now I've told you that part of the story. Now let me flip over here and tell you a couple of three little stories here. Like, the Federal Reserve notes are a first and paramount lien on all of the assets of the issuing Federal Reserve Bank. That's cited from Moody's Bank and Financial Manual, page 2105. Federal Reserve notes and national bank notes may be used to pay an obligation evidenced by usual form of promissory note, Berry versus Los Angeles County. This case was over Wallace Berry, the movie actor, and the notes in question were redeemable in lawful money and would pay to the bearer on demand. Now take a look at your notes today, and it says, this note is legal tender for all debts public and private. And I want you to notice that after the word private, there is no period. No period. So that's not a complete sentence. Then the rest of the sentence should read, and is redeemable in lawful money at any Federal Reserve Bank or the Treasury of the United States. Period. Now that's the full citation or quotation. But you see, your Congress, first of all, cunningly coerced you into turning your gold in 1933. Then, in 1965, they cunningly coerced you into believing that you couldn't redeem those Federal Reserve notes any longer for silver or gold. And they took away this redeemability. So you could redeem those silver certificates up until about 1965 or 68, somewhere along in there. And then they closed the window. So now these paper notes are not redeemable in anything. In 1986, they gave us back our gold and silver coin. So now your gold and silver coin is, in fact, fully available to you and me and everybody else. That's why we use gold here at the law school. Here at the law school, we use gold and silver coin. And it's being minted now in the U.S. Mint at West Point, New York, in denominations of $50 one-ounce gold pieces, $25 half-ounce gold pieces, $10 quarter-ounce gold pieces, and $5 one-tenth-ounce gold pieces, in addition to 480-grain, 0.999 fine silver dollars are being minted right now today. Today, as I speak, those gold coins are coming out. Now, 5% of the people of America are in possession of 100% of all the gold and silver. It's not my fault that Mrs. Kello doesn't have her share. It's not my fault that you, listening to me right now, don't have your share of gold and silver. Now, remember that God said, you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. Let me show you this law again. It's predicated upon the law in Exodus chapter 20 that says, thou shalt not steal. Let's see if I can cite that. I think it's Exodus 20, about verse 15, is it? That is, thou shalt not steal. Exodus 20:15 is extrapolated in this statute that says, Deuteronomy 25:13, you shall not have in your bag diverse weights of great and the small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures of great and the small. But you shall have a perfect and a just weight, a perfect and a just measure shall you have, that your days may be lengthened in the land which the Eternal your God gives you. Statute number one. Statute number two is Leviticus 19, 35 and 36. Let me see if I can find that one. Leviticus 19, verse 35 and 36. You shall do no unrighteousness in judgment, in meat yard, in weight, or in measure. Just balances, just weights, a just ephah, and a just hin shall you have. I am the Eternal your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt. just weights and balances are not embraced by Federal Reserve notes or by mortgages, commercial paper, stocks, or bonds. Now, we have been led down the primrose path, boys and girls, and as a result of that primrose path, we have given up some very valuable rights. And the most valuable right is your right to property. Now, in 1995, I believe it was, a case came out which dealt with, let's see if I can give you a citation here. The case number I've got on here is 953666. It comes off of Find Law. So if you'll go to your computer and you go to Find Law, and you look up a case over here, which is, see if I can get the citation here for you, called the Norwest Bank of Fort Collins versus American Life and Casualty. It's an insurance company. It's a Gold Clause case. It was submitted on April 10th, 1996, and it was decided August 14th, 1996, before Bowman, Beam, and Murphy Circuit judges. This is the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeal. This case involves a gold clause contained in a 99-year commercial property lease originally executed in 1917. American Life and Casualty Insurance Company is the current lessee, having acquired the leasehold interest in 1990. The lessors, successors, and interest to the original lessor brought this contract action against American Life after it refused to pay its monthly rent installments in gold coin as specified in the original lease. The district court granted summary judgment in favor of American Life on the basis that the gold clause had been erased from the 1917 lease by the 1933 Act of Congress. We reverse and remand. And that's because gold had been reestablished in 1986. And so we have our gold and silver coin back, boys and girls, as a matter of law. Whether or not you use it is another story, isn't it? So let me give you that case again. It's called Norwest Bank of Fort Collins versus American Life and Casualty Insurance Company. You can go to Find Law and pick that up. It's case number 953666. All right, now that'll tell you a little something about what happened to gold and silver and why I said to you that it was House Joint Resolution 192 that caused us our problem. It's not the problem of the Supreme Court. Now, the efforts of a decision, or the effects, rather, of a decision of unconstitutionality. A decision by the High Court or Supreme Court that either a post-1937 law is repugnant to the Constitution, the date from which the impugned law itself is invalid, or two, the consequences or acts done in reliance upon the law prior to the date of the judgment. A question arises, when is a law unconstitutional? Is it unconstitutional from the time that it's discovered to be unconstitutional, or is it unconstitutional ab initio from the time it was enacted? And the answer is, a law is unconstitutional from the time that it was enacted. Now, House Joint Resolution 192 is not unconstitutional, because there was no penalty imposed upon you for not turning your gold in. The Congress didn't make a law. They said it's against public policy. Article 1, Section 10 says that no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. Congress came along and said, because of this emergency in 1933, it's against public policy. Turn your gold in. Let's all work together. Many people turned their gold in. Corporations had to turn their gold in. But individuals did not. Now, my granddad walked down to Bank of America, stood in line, and turned his gold coin in. Just like all other Americans. Turned in their gold coin. And they did that because of U.S. versus Minker. Because of what appears to be a lawful command on the surface, many citizens, because of their respect for what appears to be law, are cunningly coerced into waiving their rights due to ignorance. U.S. versus Minker, 350 U.S. 179. That's cited on page 187. My granddad, just like your granddad and everybody else's granddad, actually believed that that was the law and they had to do that. Now, that law would have been unconstitutional had it ever been challenged. Nobody ever challenged the law. Everybody just accepted it. After all, there was a Great Depression. Unemployment was 25%. We do the same thing today in the war over Iraq. We believe that the President and the Congress are doing all of the right things, that the Patriot Act and Homeland Security and searches and national identification and one thing and another are laws, and that we need to respect those laws. The truth is, they're unconstitutional enactments that have never been challenged, never been taken before the Supreme Court for an adjudication as to their constitutionality. And that's the way government operates, by bluff and bravado. Bluff and bravado. They bark a lot, threaten, intimidate, scare. They use fear. There are five elements to human nature, five elements that cause you to be motivated to action, and that is vanity, number one, you're a vain person. Jealousy, you're jealous of somebody else. Lust, you have an inordinate desire. Greed, you can't control your emotions. Or fear, you are afraid. Now, God made this observation in Leviticus 26. He said, you will fear at the falling of a leaf. You will run when a leaf falls. You will be shaken. You will be fearful and timid. And Americans today are just exactly that. They're fearful and timid. Running from falling leaves. Running from the fear of terrorism. There were battles fought in the Bible in which in one day 500,000, that's a half a million Israelites, were killed in one day's battle. That's the world record, by the way. In World War I, there were three battles in which 40,000 plus people were killed. That's just English. We don't know how many Germans died that day. In the Civil War, there were battles like the Battle of Gettysburg. 15,000 Confederate soldiers killed in 2 hours on the Gettysburg battlefield, called Pickett's Charge. 15,000. Why, there haven't been that many people killed worldwide in the last 25 years by terrorists. Now, I tell you, boys and girls, we've been bamboozled. And as a result of that, we have surrendered rights, privileges, and immunities that our founding fathers created in our Constitution that Americans today, because they have been sent to Volksschulen and dumbed down, not very many Americans are any longer able to think. Unable to think. And so, when you read about the Supreme Court's decision in Kello, when somebody says to you, my God, this is a violation of our rights. Yeah, your rights have been violated, but it wasn't by the Supreme Court. It was by your president and your Congress. And that occurred in 1933. All right, we're about out of time here, boys and girls. We're going to have to cut it off right here. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. I'll tell you a little more about the Kello story when we come back. Keep in mind that the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. All right, there it is. Time's up. The producer says it's time to quit, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.